The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cause. Bill Rettelmeyer is joining me, the owner of Southbrook Vineyards here in Niagara-on-the-Lake in Four Mile Creek, sub-Appalachian. Bill, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Well, you know, Matt, you can give me lots of compliments, but calling me an interesting person is one of the best.
Okay, absolutely. Well, I mean, trust me, I've gone through your background, and I am very interested in just your journey, in your transformation from where you started to now. But I think just the first place, just very simple, before we get into the journey, how would you describe, like, if you were selling people to come to Southbrook Winery, how would you sell it?
We do really interesting stuff. We're trying to be integral with what we stand for, which is, and I hate the term sustainability because it's so vague.
Yeah, I heard that in interviews. Why do you hate that term?
Up until fairly recently, there was no definition. And when something isn't defined, there's an incredible amount of greenwashing that goes on. Now there is a definition of quote, sustainability in the wine business, which is pretty good. And as long as it's third-party audited, I'm happy to go along with it. Mm-hmm. We do things like organics, but we only do it when it's third-party audited. Biodynamics, the building is LEED Gold. It's not, we're sustainable. Here is the definition, and here's somebody else has looked at it and agrees with us. So to me, that's what's important.
You said LEED Gold. I was wondering if you could explain that to listeners.
So LEED is a whole bunch of points. It's Leadership in Energy Efficient Design. It's a North American, now worldwide, standard for new buildings, mostly one-off, so architecturally designed. And what it says is that we've looked at all of the different parts of the building, and you don't have to be perfect in every case, but it's made up of about 90 points. And if you get 65 or more, then you're LEED Gold. If you get 75 or 80 more, then your LEED Platinum. There's also LEED Silver, LEED Bronze. And it's getting slightly easier as time goes on because they're adding new points.
Right.
So the a Platinum is the old, or Platinum is the new gold, I guess we should call it.
Now, if you want to name names, please feel free. I'm not going to, I'll get out of the way and let you go on. I'll put the mic down and go to the sampling table. But are there wineries out there that trade on, we are a sustainable winery, we are organic, but they use all the catchphrases, but maybe they're like a fat-free Fudgio cookie. It might be fat-free, but there's lots of chemicals and sugars that are still going to, aren't good for you. Are there vineyards out there that sort of trade on those terms, but maybe aren't the most honest about it?
No, I think most people are working towards it, but if everybody is working on a different definition, it's hard to make it consistent. So, for instance, if you're growing grapes in California, it's way easier to be fungicide free or whatever. But they're also using huge amounts of water. It's easy to be fungicide free if there's no humidity.
Right.
The worst example was, I remember we used to buy peaches from somebody and they put on all of their baskets herbicide free. Well, you don't use herbicide in a peach orchard.
So they're telling the truth.
They're telling the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I like, rather than making a claim ourselves, we use third-party certification.
Right.
So we never used to use the word sustainable until the regulations and the system for certifying sustainability in Ontario vineyards and wineries was created. And it was something that we'd been pushing for because consumer is interested in it, but you've got to watch out the marketing guys. So always look for third party certification.
That's, yeah, it's a great point, and you're right, because then it's complete transparency. It's taken away from you, and there's no sort of monkeying around with titles. And sometimes it's not even about lying, but it's about bending the truth for your marketing needs.
Well, or even just bending the truth because you don't know what the truth is.
Right. That's fair. I'd love to hear about your journey. You You went from a roadside vegetable stand in the 1980s to now, how many cases a year do you guys make?
We're not huge. We're doing maybe 15,000 cases a year, ballpark. Yeah. We'd rather be high quality than huge. We can't be all things to all people. We can't. Ontario's a terrible place to try and make cheap wine.
Yeah.
It makes more sense where the cost of labor or the efficiency of the climate is better. So we think all great wine comes from regions that are sketchy as far as the climate is concerned. If it's an easy place to grow grapes, the grapes will take it easy and you won't get those wonderful flavors. So if you think, and I'm old enough that I think in a European form, if you think about Champagne and Burgundy and Bordeaux, they're all on the edge of, it's easier to grow grapes in southern France, but they're never going to be as good as those ones on the edge. I was born and brought up on a farm in Richmond Hill, and I've basically been a farmer all my life. But to save boredom, I reinvent myself every 7 or 8 years. So I started as a dairy operator, then became a cash crop farmer, became a market garden, and I realized what I really love is the interaction with people. If I'm growing cash crops, I'm driving by myself on a tractor, the quality is consistent, and it's really boring. We'd much rather be able to get instant feedback from the customers. I like this wine, I don't like this wine.
Was there a moment, like what was your epiphany? What was your, wait a minute, I am going to pursue, because you don't go in this half-ass. I'm going to go into the winemaking business. What, was there a moment, what led you to this?
Well, I'll go a little earlier than that.
My
wife's fault.
Okay.
I quit smoking back in the 1980s, and as a thank you present, my wife gave me a wine appreciation tasting with Jacques Marie in Toronto, and that's where the passion came out as far as wine is concerned, and the striving to do the best that we can, because I don't care what you do, you should be the best at what you do. And then the winemaking, it was a lot more fun than selling strawberry, pick your own, and raspberries and that sort of thing. So,
and what made you decide on this property? Like, what led you to here in Four Mile Creek?
So the property we were looking, if you look at my cellar and my interest, it's always been Bordeaux, white Burgundy, but really it's Bordeaux. I'm going to say out of 1,500 bottles in my cellar, at least half are Bordeaux's. And this is the most Bordelaise, Bordeaux-style area. We're the warmest area in Niagara-on-the-Lake. The property was large enough. The original property was 75 acres. It was planted with Bordeaux reds. It was in a great location to make a statement. It's at the entrance to Niagara. Lots of road frontage, great road, and that sort of thing. And then we'd been working with Jack Diamond, who's the architect that did the Opera House, among other things. And we just wanted to continue working with him, came up with this design, which I love, and here we are.
All right, before I've got a philosophical question for you, but we're gonna put that to the side for a quick moment. Give me your highlights. Give me the highlights in your cellar. And as someone who loves Bordeaux, and I dipped my toe in the 2015 futures because it was my first year going there for my 40th birthday. So a lot of the vineyards that we visited, I wanted to buy the wine from that year. Just A, it was a great vintage. B, it's just really good wine and just a reminder. But what are some of your, what are the ones you're looking at and you're like, I can't wait to get to you?
Well, that's always a problem, because when you first start buying wine, you buy a bottle of this and a bottle of this and a bottle of this because you want to try everything.
Yeah.
And then as you get more into wine, you start buying half cases, but at the same time you start buying half cases, you never want to finish the last bottle. And what you realize is all the single bottles that you bought are not only your single bottle, but they're your last bottle. And so you save the damn things for way too long.
Like, okay, again, I'm still gonna ask you for some of the specifics, but before that, you're right. There's such a psychological thing. It's like the end of that moment, that memory, like the end of that bottle. It's It feels so much more significant to people that like really cherish wine than other people going, what's the big deal? Just finish it and get something else.
Exactly. Exactly. But before kids back in the 1980s.
So much cheaper.
Well, I'm not sure they were a whole bunch on an actual cost basis.
Mm-hmm.
They seem like they're a lot cheaper now. Plus, there's been this huge extension. It used to be that a first growth was 3 times the price of a generic Bordeaux. And today it's 100 times more. And so I have very few first growth Bordeaux's because I was always too cheap, but lots of really nice seconds and thirds and fourths. So things like mid-80s Lynch Bage, Léoville Lascasse. First case I ever bought was a case of 82 Lascasse on futures, and I paid $9 a bottle for it.
I hate you so much. Like, thank you. You make great wine, and thank you for taking the time to do this. Time is so important. But when I hear that, I'm just like, oh my, it's like I want to travel back in time, first murder Hitler, then go buy some 1982 second growth.
Right. But there's other wines which were the same price or even more now are worth far less. So things like Torres Mastaplana was $35 in the mid 30s, and it's $45 now.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's
yeah.
But the critical thing about wine is it's there to share.
Yeah.
So the idea is that you get together with people that you know will appreciate it, and then you want to open them. And it's been wonderful the last little while. My son Andrew's now a sommelier. I love sharing wine with him.
Yeah.
Because I know he's going to appreciate it.
Oh, it's so true. It's funny. I'd rather, like, I will never share wine that I wouldn't drink on my own. But the really good stuff, I'd rather drink it with someone I don't know as well, but really knows wine, than my best friend who just, you know, just wants a glass of wine.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I would agree.
Yeah.
And the problem is, as wine gets older, it becomes even more esoteric, and it becomes, you know, you have to be ready for what you're drinking, but they are certainly exciting.
Yeah, I mean, opened up some old 04 single Hermitage from Chapoutier and had that with a friend who I knew really was going to appreciate wine. I got my big philosophical on a lot of other stuff, but when you got that 82, the case was 82...
Lascasse,
yes. What was the story behind it? Why was it that one? What motivated you when you decided to get the futures? What was it about that?
Winter of 1984, I was in Scotland, bored, and we were staying at a bed and breakfast, and the guy collected old decanter magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I read through them, and they would have a vintage guide, and I realized that they would pick the wines of the year. And the first growths were always there, but they were too expensive.
Yeah.
But I'd never heard of Léoville Lascasse, but every year they recommended Léoville Lascasse.
Yeah.
And a wine merchant called Christopher's had a list, and it was on sale for, I think, £100, and at the time the pound was about $1.20 or so. And so I took a chance and bought it.
Good risk.
Absolutely.
How different is the wine culture in Canada when you were doing the vegetable thing in the mid-80s versus now, in terms of tastes, how much we drink, knowledge, all that kind of stuff?
So everybody always tells me how bad Canadian wine used to be. But the thing was that people were asking for that. They were asking for high alcohol. They were asking for sweet. They were asking for unsophisticated. Because if you were a sophisticated wine drinker, you would automatically buy French. If you were a sophisticated Italian wine... No, if you were an Italian wine drinker, you would buy Italian wines. If you were... Whatever. American wines weren't on the market, really. It was Gallo's Hearty Red Burgundy, because that's what they were asking for as well.
Back in the day when you could put the word Burgundy on a bottle of California wine.
My mother is downsizing, and so she was getting rid of all of the old gourmet magazines that she had saved for years. And I read most of them. And the interesting thing about it, they had their wine commentator, Gerald Asher, had been the commentator from the 1960s until it closed in the 2000s. So it was like a snapshot. Every year, every month, you could read something that Gerald Asher was talking about. And in the 1970s, he was talking about these wonderful Burgundies and these wonderful Bordeaux. He was starting to talk about great German wines and great Italian wines. And then once a year, he would have what is the best $5 jug wine available from the United States.
Yeah.
Right. So they weren't looking for great wine from the United States. And then all of a sudden, now you read him and he's looking about the high-end wine. So it's what's being demanded has changed.
I feel bad for the Canadian winemaker in the 80s who wanted to make great wine, but there was absolutely no market for it because it's almost like there was a prejudice against, or not a disbelief that Canada could produce something that would be on the level of France or Italy.
Sure, but in the 70s,
in that period,
you had Don Zeraldo and Carl Kaiser get together and say they got the first new license in Ontario since 1933, 27 actually. Everybody thinks Prohibition ended in 33. Canada was 27. Nobody had been asking for good quality. And I remember seeing Don slogging to try and say, we can make great wine in Ontario. And if you tasted those wines today, you wouldn't pick them up as great wines.
Yeah.
But they were earth shaking when it happened.
What changed? Or like, it's not one thing, because it's like anything. Everything's just a slow tectonic shift. What's changed in terms the perception of Ontario wine is vastly different in 2018 than what it was in the late 70s to mid 80s.
We can ask more than $2.65 a bottle.
Yeah.
And to make good wine costs money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you've got to get good grapes, you've got to be selective, you've got to use good barrels, you've got all these different things. And at $2.65, which I think is what I started to buy in a Skillin at, you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You couldn't do it.
Do you identify yourself more as a farmer or as a winery owner?
I wear two hats. I consider myself really to be a farmer as much as anything else. But the winery owner, it's a lot of it is about marketing and making sure that what you make you're able to sell at a reasonable amount. I look at what Robert Mondavi did in the States, and I consider Don Zeraldo to be very similar to him, to Mondavi, of working not for their own winery, but working for the industry. And I would be honored to be thought of as doing the same thing. The more we can work together, the stronger we will all be.
You're on the board member on the VQA?
I have retired.
You've retired.
Last summer for the first time in 10 years. Yeah.
What is the VQA? What do they need to do? What is their job in terms of helping to push Ontario wine to the next level? It's Niagara, Pelee Island, Prince Edward County. What do they need to do?
So the critical thing is, and I joined the board of the VQA, and then the first thing they reminded me of is that it is not a promotional organization.
Okay.
It is a regulatory organization.
Yep.
But one of the things that in British Columbia, it's referred to as the BC VQA. So what's the most important part of it? BC VQA.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that VQAO is the wrong way around. It should be OVQA. Because the most important part for the consumer is the fact that VQA is always and always will be 100% Ontario.
What do you think the hesitancy is from the VQA not to adopt that? Is it more of a concern that they don't want to stray away from their job is to regulate quality?
No, I think it's inertia as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But and this is not necessarily the policy of the board. But to me, I do farmers markets. I meet people. And
yeah, you guys are all over the place. Like I see you and your son Andrew. You know, pouring wine all over Ontario on the weekends.
But that's what's important because somebody said once it's all about lips on glasses.
Yeah. Butts in seats for sporting events. And lips on glasses.
I never exactly.
thought about that. That's perfect.
Yeah. It was a ripoff of, you know what R&D stands for? Rip off and duplicate. and that was not my expression, but I'm sure that's lips on glasses lips came on, from yeah. butts on seats.
Yeah.
But people want to support Ontario, but I remember getting into a big argument at farmer's market when a guy told me that only 25% of what was in the bottle was Ontario, and I said, no, that's wrong, it's 100%. He said, no, I know it's only 25%. And I said, no, I'm on the board.
Yeah.
It's 100%. And he left without believing me.
This Isn't that odd? Like, imagine being so sure about yourself when you don't have the facts. In some ways, what a very easy way to live a life.
So it's great. All you have to, if you get into that, yeah. you can become president of the U.S.
Done and done. That job's, yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't get political.
Oh, no. Listen, do you know how many times I talk about climate change on this podcast? Anyway, by the way, I'm going to get political. And if you can make an argument for Trump, I'm here to listen to it. I'd be kind of shocked. What motivated you guys to go fully biodynamic and just the organic viticulture? You guys have been tip of the spear of it. I imagine it's just from your farming background.
So organics, as far as I'm concerned, is a social issue.
Mm-hmm.
It by not using as many chemicals and the chemicals that we use are much less aggressive, it's better for the earth, it's better for the environment. But my feeling is I don't want to ask my staff to do anything I don't want to do.
Yeah.
And I don't want to ask one of my staff members to go out, work with chemicals, and then go home and wash his clothes in the same washing machine that his kids' clothes are washed in.
Yeah.
We used to have somebody work for us, and one of the chemicals that we were supposed to use, it prevented earworm in corn, was an organophosphate, and the LD50 was about 50 micrograms. And that sounds harmless, except an LD50 is the dose, the lethal dose, that will kill 50% of the people that will consume it. So 50 micrograms meant that 1 milliliter, 1 gram,
yeah.
will kill half of 20 people. And it comes in 15-liter jugs. So properly divided, that 15-liter jug will kill 300,000 people, half of 300,000 people.
Jesus.
I don't want to handle that shit.
And yeah.
if I don't want to handle it, why would I ask my staff members to do it? So...
That's a great answer.
That's where the organics came from.
Yeah.
Biodynamics is completely different.
Of course.
Biodynamics makes, and is organic wine better? Some people, there was a scientific study that says the average is about 1 point better on a 90-point or 100-point scale. Yeah, it's better. Biodynamics, there's no doubt. It is better. You talk about Cristal. Had 4 full-page ads in the New Yorker last year. And never once did they come out and talk about biodynamics, but it was all the dog whistles. It was talking about burying manure in cow horns.
Right.
It was planting and harvesting and making wine using phases of the moon. It was having animals in the vineyard. Every single one of them was a dog whistle that said, that's biodynamics. And I figure... if they're selling $350 champagne and can't keep it in stock, there's got to be something about it. It's not just marketing. Domaine de la Romanée Conti,
yeah.
Bise-Loire, all of the great wine estates are either certified or using biodynamic principles.
Explain to me, because, you know, there's a lot of it I understand. Like the animals in the farm, the manure, the bear in the horn, like all that stuff makes sense. Explain the role of lunar energy with making a good Bordeaux blend.
So I was speaking at a function in Nova Scotia, and I was in Pete Luckett's vineyard. Wonderful! It's an amazing vineyard. It's right on the, it's not the Bay of Fundy, it's the next little bay over, Minas Basin, I think. And really great marketer. He had a early on to internet phone calls, and so he bought himself an old British telephone booth, put it in the middle of the vineyard, and you could make phone calls anywhere in the world from this what a great Instagrammable function.
Yeah.
So I'm facing, talking to this guy, and he's telling me I am so full of crap about lunar whatever, and I'm facing downhill, he's facing uphill. And he's going on and on and on about me. How can the moon have any effect on the earth? And I go, can we swap places? He goes, why? I said, just swap places with me. So we turned around and he goes, oh, there is a 3-mile mud flat right behind him because Fundy has the highest tides in the world.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, I guess the moon affects the Earth. What is it that does it? I don't know. But one of my earliest memories was helping in my mother's garden. And my mother had an old retired farmer, Elmer Boynton was his name. And as we're planting peas, he's telling me that his grandfather had told him that if you want the roots of plants, you plant during a waning moon. And if you want the tops of plants, so peas or lettuce or whatever, you plant during a waxing moon. And you'll always get your coldest temperatures during a full moon. And he said that his grandfather had told him that. Now, he started working on what became my family farm. He was working for the previous owner. He started work on the farm in 1904. So his grandfather would have told him this late 1800s, early 1900s, before there were all of the crutches of chemicals that we have today, mm-hmm. all of the insecticides, the herbicides, the fungicides, the fertilizers. So is it perfect? No, but it's better than nothing. And so now when we start to lose or want to not use all of these chemical crutches, we go back to
just the origin.
The origin.
Yeah.
But I've told people this, and most people agree with me. Yes, my grandfather told me the same thing. My grandfather always planted by the moon. But what's really interesting, Elmer was from Yorkshire, so northern England, but I've heard the same from Scots. I've heard it from Italians. I've heard it, Italians will, you don't get your hair cut during a new moon because it doesn't grow back as well. I've heard it from South Asians. I've heard it from Chinese. I've heard it from Japanese. I've heard it from everybody. And the funniest story about that I've heard was Anne was talking to the people from Hank, which was Jamie Kennedy's old bakery. And she was up there one day, it was a full moon, and she made some comment about she was trying to rack wine and it wouldn't settle down. And all these people, they're bakers as well as waitstaff, yeah. And they all go, that sounds absolutely crazy. And so Anne, who's a sideways thinker, has this brilliant thought. She goes, you guys are all bakers, right? They go, yeah. She says, can you make sourdough bread during a full moon? And they all go, no, everybody knows you can't make sourdough bacon.
What?
And she goes, okay, we're doing the same thing. We're making yeast, except you're keeping the carbon dioxide and I'm keeping the alcohol.
Yeah. That's funny. Bunch of years back, there was, we see it every now and then, the small upstart country versus Bordeaux. And your 2002 Cab Merlot beat out Lafite, beat out Chateau Margaux, beat out some pretty heavy hitters. I'm just curious a little bit about what that was all about.
Warm vintage.
Yep.
Low yields, made impeccably. I don't want to beat them. Mm-hmm. I want to be put in the same group.
Yeah.
It was actually embarrassing.
What year was that, by the way?
It was 2004.
Yeah.
That was Larry Patterson's last. And I always said to Larry, you're doing the wrong thing. You should be doing this with Chardonnay, not Bordeaux blends. But Larry loved Bordeaux. It's exactly the same as Spurrier's Judgment of Paris in 1976. You know, you do that mixture. It's what Robert Mondavi made his reputation on, going and tasting his wines against Lafite, Latour, that sort of thing. Not necessarily beating them, but being in the same
in the conversation. Yeah. Yeah.
Our problem is in Canada, we're a colonial country. Sounds ridiculous, as are the Americans, as are the Australians. And we don't appreciate what we have here until somebody from England usually says that this stuff is really good.
Yeah.
And then we go, wow, this is wonderful.
Same thing with our musicians and our actors.
Absolutely.
When they go to the States and they win Grammys, Oscars, Emmys, then we're like, oh, wow, look at them. But when they're here doing good work, we don't treat it the same way.
Right. You know, is there a Canadian comedian left? No, I shouldn't say that. But they're all down in the States.
Yeah.
And everybody in the States recognizes that we turn out great comedians, great musicians.
Great Chardonnay and great Bordeaux blends.
Absolutely.
But how did it feel? Like when you guys, I'm curious if you could take me to that scene when your wine beat all these first growths. And yes, for you, you want to be in the conversation. It makes sense, but there must have been part of you where your little sting of pride must have been circulating.
Absolutely, but what was even better is that we weren't the only one in the mix. In the top five, there were three Bordeaux, but there were two Canadian wines.
Ah, that's a good
point.
And
to me, that was what was important. And it's the industry that's important. It's not any one winery.
It's sort of like it floats. Everyone's boat gets floated on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I saw this quote. You're doing the TV show Corkscrewed, and you wrote, "We in the wine business, we focus on people that know a whole bunch about wine rather than growing the industry, growing the customer base. I think it's really positive to put Ontario wine, to put Canadian wine in the forefront, to talk about it on the same level as most imports."
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, because the average Canadian, especially now, younger generation, my generation, look down on Canadian wine, but to me what's even more important is the younger generation has not got those prejudices. One of the things the LCBO does is it tends not to bring the real crap into the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to France and you can find an awful lot of really bad wine. You go to the States, you find an awful lot of really bad wine. The LCBO doesn't bring that stuff in. And so you see the best here from the United States, from France, from Australia, from Chile, from Argentina, whereas you tend to see everything from Ontario.
You're right. I love this other quote. People ask who my competitors are, and they expect me to say Jackson, Triggs, and Pilateri, but my competitors are Seagram's and Labatt's. If anyone's having a good experience drinking Ontario wine, it's positive for Southbrook.
Absolutely. And that came from when we used to grow pick your own strawberries.
Mm-hmm.
And people would say, who's your competitor, expecting me to name the person down the road.
Yeah.
And my answer was always Cineplex Odeon. What should we do today?
Right.
Should we go to the movies or should we go and pick strawberries? And if we can, at this point, right now, VQA makes up about 10% of the wine that's sold in Ontario. That's a wonderful opportunity, because if you're in France, 98% of what you're drinking is French.
Yep.
So if I want to build my business, I have to steal it from my next door neighbor. Whereas here,
you guys are all in it together.
Right. But 50% of the people don't drink wine in Canada. So anyone I can convince to drink wine, that's a bonus.
Yep.
And then the next step is anybody I can convince to drink Ontario as opposed to Chile, Argentina, or whatever.
10% of Ontarians drink VQA wine.
No. Sorry. 10% of the wine sold in Ontario is VQA.
Right. Okay. What's that percentage in BC for BC wine?
22.
So why is BC more than double the amount that Ontario is?
BC has always been much more passionate about BC.
Why is Ontario not more passionate about Ontario?
I would say that we're not passionate about Ontario anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because we think that Canada, I was sitting in a hot tub in Alberta one time, not telling anybody where I was from. And somebody said, they started to tell Ontario jokes. And one of the Ontario jokes was, how many Ontarians does it take to change a light bulb?
Yeah.
And the answer is one, because they think that if they hold the bulb up with their hand, the rest of the world will rotate around them. So we tend to be more outward facing. BC, I think, also has a higher, for instance, loyalty to Oregon, Washington, and California.
Yeah.
Whereas we tend to have loyalty towards United States, forget about whether it's California, but also Chile, Argentina. And to some extent, it's the LCBO is following trends and selling wine that is being asked for, whereas the BCLDB has had the direction from the provincial government, you should be promoting. It's a good thing if you promote BC wines.
So if Doug Ford was here, Well, that'd be an interesting conversation. Would you tell him to look to BC?
I would love to.
Or even the heads of the LCBO, same kind of thing.
They do what they're told to. They think to maximize.
Right.
Whereas, so if you drink, for every liter of Ontario wine sold in Ontario, it generates about $14 in economic activity in Ontario. And for every liter of imported wine, it generates something like 50 cents worth of economic activity.
Why are we not promoting it more? I mean, just that stat is ridiculous.
It's crazy. But how do you promote it? And we've got to be really careful. If we really promote it too much, then we open ourselves to trade discussions. And you know, that the Americans are in the process of trying to sue us because they're not. They feel that they're being picked on and not getting any proper promotion in Ontario, particularly. But when free trade came in 1988, there was $60 million worth of California wine sold in Ontario. And this year it should be around $1 billion. So I think they're doing okay.
Yeah, I think they're doing fine. Bill, before we end this, and again, appreciate you sitting down. Your one son, Andrew, is into wine. How did that happen? Did he tell you, I want to get in the biz? Did you do the thing where you, in all the movies, and the stereotype is that the father figure says, son, don't go in this business. How did that go?
Never really discussed it with him. He does look back at some of the trips we made and hits himself over the head because he, you know, at 11, 12, 13, something like that, maybe a little older, we were in New Zealand and we were going to places like Craggy Range and Felton Road and all these other things.
Yeah.
Half the time they weren't getting out of the car.
Oh, and now he goes, oh my God. Oh, what are you doing? We're in Hawke's Bay. Try this Syrah. You'll love it.
The thing is that unlike most other pleasures, wine is such an esoteric, you know, you can drink wine because you like the effect of it. But really, if you're going to do that, you're going to drink beer.
Yeah.
And it's going to be crap.
Yeah.
Or you're going to drink vodka or tequila or whatever. Wine is such a contemplative thing. It's exciting. Every different wine that you drink is a different wine.
Mm-hmm.
And people always say to me, and I think it's a really important differentiator. People say that I'm a wine connoisseur, and I hate that term.
Oh, yeah? How come?
Because connoisseur... This is one of the few things by having taken Latin. Connoisseur means to know.
Yeah.
And my feeling is I can never know it.
Nope.
Whereas amateur, we think of it as not a professional. No. Amateur comes from Latin to love.
So we are wine amateurs.
I am a wine amateur.
Because we love it. And one thing I discovered, when you start to learn about wine, you discover, I ain't going to know. I'm not even going to get close.
If you think you know a lot about wine, you by definition don't.
Oh, yeah. It's 100% true.
And what's even cooler is you walk into a place like Vinexpo, which might have 25,000 wines on display.
Yeah.
And 24,000 of those will be different from the last time you went.
Yeah, I know. It's nuts.
Because of vintage date.
What do you hope Southbrook is? Because you got to retire soon because you said every 7-8 years you get bored. So
no, I just changed myself.
Just change. Okay,
I don't get bored, but it just becomes more
little
exciting.
Reinvention.
So what I want Southbrook to be is a burning. We got a lead gold. We got what I think is one of the most beautiful wineries here. What I want is somebody else to slap a design down and say, you thought that's good?
Mm-hmm.
This one's even better.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with wine. We make a really good wine. I want somebody to come and say, I can do better than that. I've used your example, and this is how I can make it better. And that, to me, I'd love it if somebody can become recognized that the sustainability, not just as far as the environment is concerned, but economic, by working towards the Canadian industry, doing all of these things. Yeah, that's what I would like.
Bill, really appreciate, as I said before in the interview with Ann, I love this vineyard, and the best way to explain it is not by any flowery speech, But that, you know, I recently purchased a mixed case of a lot of your guys' products. So
wonderful.
I've always been a big fan. I always appreciated at your tasting area that you guys would sell some of your older wines. Usually you don't get a lot of library selection, especially in the new world. So I appreciate that.
When I was learning about wine, it was all about Burgundy and Bordeaux because they were the only two great areas. They were the greatest areas in the world. And the way you knew they were great was the wines lasted.
Yeah.
And so right from the beginning, Southbrook was designing wines that would last so that you could. Andrew, when he was born during our first harvest, during our first crush. So he's got 12 magnums of his birth year wine. And I had a couple in the cellar. When he turned 21, I opened one.
Yeah.
He's since opened a couple more and they're stunning.
Ah.
So remember also that every bottle of wine that you buy, you buy it with the reason that you want to put it on a table, share it with friends, and you want to tell people why you bought that bottle of wine. So my job is to give you the stories.
Bill, thank you for all your stories.
Thank you. And you've only heard a few.
I know. Listen, at some point, I will bug you a couple months down the road because now I want to ask you, what was it like during your first crush when you also have your first child? But we'll save that for another time.
My wife did most of the hard work.
You've been listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, download, subscribe, tell your friends. You can find us on Audio Boom, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever good podcasts are sold. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.